orbit around that nucleus do something. They go to a higher energy state. It can jump up to a higher orbit, or in the extreme case, the electron leaves entirely. It gets jumped to a high enough energy that it leaves the molecule, and now you've got a plasma. So mass is not required in that. It looks like an impact. It's worded as if it's an impact, but it's a wave passing into the vicinity of where those atoms are, and because of the resonance phenomena, energy gets coupled from one to the other. That's my understanding of it, Wesley. When you and I aim a radio wave, a very strong radio wave, let me drop.
Welcome to the WesleyNet. You make the comment and Wesley will ask stupid fucking questions for 2 hours.
I have a question also, Dick.
Please get boyfriend.
In the case of the HARP experiment, where very strong radio signals are aimed up at the ionosphere, and the ionosphere is partially absorptive, partially reflective, at those particular frequencies, energy gets coupled between that radio wave and that ionosphere, or that ionospheric material, and the total number of atoms that become ionized increases. And you've now created an artificial ionosphere. Mass transfer is not required, is my understanding, for that process to take place. Just the fact that the wave is an electromagnetic wave, it has photons, it contains energy in those photons. Those photons are at a particular frequency or at a particular wavelength, and those molecules in that atmosphere are responsive to that wavelength and become excited. And once they become excited, they get partially ionized. Once they're ionized, you and I call that a plasma. We call it an ionosphere, and we've now created it by aiming that radio wave at that material at that altitude. That's my understanding. I don't think I know it all. There's been a couple of articles in QST Magazine, among other places, that do a better job of explaining it. Over to you, John, KC2WGB, K2RIW.
K2RIW.
Assume that this gas chromatograph is actually measuring a type of Q of the substance we're examining?
I agree with that. You are measuring the Q. When you plot that curve of response versus wavelength, first of all, you're measuring at what wavelength it is resonant to. You're measuring the degree of resonance. And because those resonance curves sometimes have a peak or a valley, that it has a particular width to the peak or the valley, you could interpret that as a Q. When I'm using my grid dip meter, and I'm measuring the frequency of resonance of a coil, an LC network, if I make the LC network, if I've got three of them on the table, and every one of them has got the exact same resonant frequency, but one of them has no resistor across the coil, one of them has a 1 megohm resistor, one of them's got a 10 kiloohm resistor, and one of them's got a 100 ohm resistor across the coil. It's obvious by the ones with the lower and lower resistance resistor across the coil will have lower and lower Q. With my grid dip meter, as I sweep in frequency, I will find either a very sharp dip or a very broad dip. In the case of the very low Q coils, I have to make the grid dip meter fall much closer to the coil in order for me to measure the dip, and the dip will occur across a broader bandwidth. So a grid dip meter is measuring the Q of the coil. By way of that chromatograph curve, you could say I'm measuring the Q of that particular resonance of that particular molecule, and that's part of its signature, in my opinion. Over to you, John.
Yeah, that's what it seemed to be to me. We're actually looking at the Q structure of the element. So let's get back to Wesley.
Wesley, the Polish fucking idiot.
Can you
hear me?
We're hearing you very well, Wesley. Go right ahead.
Like a fucking...
Okay, once for all, I want to straight up a the doubt that I have and uncertainties that I have, the photon in the total vacuum, it doesn't have mass, so it is immune to the magnetic field. So the Lorentz law does not apply to it, right or wrong?
I think I agree with that. Everything I know about a electromagnetic wave tells me it does not respond to a magnetic field, or if there is a response, it's an extremely minor one. That radio wave, when it travels around the Earth, is doing that because of the ionosphere, not because the Earth has a magnetic field. Now, I will admit that certain materials that are being excited in a plasma, in other words, the ionized material that you have around certain stellar nebula, in other words, there are certain stars that have exploded, and there's a whole lot of gaseous material around those stars, and those stars, in many cases, are lighting up that material, exciting it by the emission of that star. And now that material re-emits. It's the material that re-emits that does respond to a magnetic field, and that's called the Zeeman effect. In the case of the Zeeman effect, the single line of resonance splits into two separate lines, and with your radio telescope, you measure those two separate lines of emission, and you know the magnitude of the local magnetic field. So the magnetic field is responding with the plasma material, not necessarily the electromagnetic wave. It creates, in the presence of a magnetic wave, magnetic field, the emitting material in that plasma around that star has these two characteristic lines, and the separation of those two lines and the strength of the two lines tells you the strength of the magnetic field. So even though you might be 50 light years away from that star, by this remote phenomena called the Zeeman effect, you are measuring the amount of the local magnetic field and the polarity of that field when you do a polarimetry experiment.
Repeater, timeout, repeater, timeout, cancel.
When you use your radio telescope to measure how much horizontal polarization, how much vertical polarization, how much clockwise and how much counterclockwise energy you're getting from that vicinity of space, by way of the Stokes parameters and other kinds of analysis, you eventually figure out what was the strength and direction of the magnetic field present in that particular chunk of plasma material in space. So there are people who misinterpret that, thinking that the magnetic field is changing the character of the electromagnetic wave itself. I don't think so. I think it's the magnetic field creating an effect on the material, the plasma material in that vicinity, which changes the way the plasma material re-emits signals when its excited electrons are jumping back down to the base state. N2XJN, K2LIW.
This is my boyfriend. His name John. He's Wesley's lover.
Hey, so, I understand what you're saying, but at the same time, what is the difference between the electromagnetic wave in structure and a photon that is electromagnetic wave? And the reason that I'm asking that question is that in physics, the Lorentz force is the force on a point charge due to the electromagnetic fields. And it does contain in its equation a force electric field, which is in volts per meter, and magnetic field in teslas. I was confused by the fact that after seeing that video, let me jump.
A stupid question every 2 fucking minutes. What an idiot!
After seeing that video about the chemi study, what popped into my mind is that the circulator should not work that is utilizing magnets and the ferrites for the microwaves in total vacuum. Back to you.
What fucking idiot.
Yeah, one of those experiments, the guy was dripping water into a tiny stream, and he was taking a charged rod, and whether the rod is charged with positive or negative charge, in either case, the stream of water got deflected towards the charge, towards the rod. And that was explained by the fact that water is a dipole molecule. You put a positive charge near the water molecule, the negative end of the molecule gets attracted, and the water deflects toward the rod. Put the opposite charge of the rod near it, the other end of the dipole molecule of the water aligns, and again you get an attractive force. The microwave oven recognizes the fact that a water molecule is a dipole molecule. It's got a positive end and a negative end, and on each half cycle of the RF wave going into your microwave oven, regardless of what frequency it is, on each half cycle, the majority of those individual water molecules flip back and forth and try to align themselves with the electromagnetic field, the E field portion of the electromagnetic wave. Because they are moving at the atomic level, by way of the RF wave that's been applied, let me drop, because there is literally a physical motion of the individual atoms or molecules of the water caused by the radio wave that's in that microwave oven. There is a coupling mechanism between the two. And the water molecule doesn't get a chance to respond 100%. He only responds 90%. In other words, he's always seeking proper alignment. By the time he gets there, the wave has reversed in cycle, and now he's got to go back in the other direction. He's always lagging. It's a hysteresis curve of lag, and that represents a energy loss mechanism, and that's the mechanism by which the water gets heated. And I've got a further step going on that one. Remember in my experiment and my explanation of why does the bottom of your bicycle pump get hot? Those individual air molecules are bouncing against each other continuously. And when there's a moving diaphragm of some kind, like the piston of the pump coming toward them, you get a doubling of velocity, the so-called ping-pong paddle effect that we've already gone through. By the same token, the individual water molecules are continuously moving at, I forget the exact number, but I think it's something, an average speed is something like 500 meters per second. And they're slamming into each other continuously. And slamming into each other, you've got to be careful how you word that. Let me drop. Whether it's air molecules that are hitting each other or water molecules that are hitting each other, these are perfectly elastic collisions. In other words, the very strong electrostatic field of electrons around each one of these objects is so strong that these objects come close to each other, the electrostatic attraction, electrostatic repulsion of equal charges. They've got a negative cloud of charge around each individual atom, and those repel each other, and so, therefore they do what looks like a bounce, as if they hit, but they never really touch. It is a thoroughly lossless encounter. However, because the water molecule is a lumpy-looking object that has a dipole polarity to it, and because that polarity is flipping back and forth at the radio frequency rate, you can now envision two water molecules about to encounter each other. Ordinarily, they would come straight toward each other, bounce, and go straight away from each other. But because they are simultaneously flipping back and forth following the radio wave, it's like having a dumbbell that's being rotated back and forth around its mass center. And now when they hit each other, and I use the word hit in parentheses, the bumpy portion that's in rotation that comes in contact means that there is a significant probability that because of the rotation taking place during the impact, that they leave each other after the bounce with a greater velocity than they had before they hit each other. That is the heating mechanism. No matter what the substance is, whether it be a gas or a liquid, if you heat it, your thermometer measures heat. What the hell is heat? Let me drop. heat and temperature is the average kinetic energy of the individual molecules. That's a fancy way of saying that if it's a solid, they are shaking in place, but they're shaking more violently. If it's a fluid, they are moving around, and when the fluid is hotter, they are moving with a greater velocity. So now you see what I believe at the molecular level is the mechanism by which the signal out of a microwave oven is able to heat the water molecules that are in your food, and that's what does the cooking in your microwave oven. It's these molecules flipping back and forth, and they're lumpy objects, and as they're flipping back and forth during the encounter, they end up pushing each other away with greater velocity. Greater velocity means higher temperature. In 2XJN, K2RIW. It's a bunch of guesses on my part.
I understand that. I have a bunch of confusion. I started to give the short questions. How would you differentiate electromagnetic wave from the photon?
There may not be a difference. Everything that you and I call an electromagnetic wave is made up of photons. That's what the wave is. You tell me what the frequency is, and by way of the Planck equation, in theory, I can tell you exactly how much energy is in each individual photon. But a wave is a stream of photons. The wave is made out of photons. I don't think you can make a wave without photons. They are that's the bricks of the building, if you know what I mean. The photons are the bricks, and the building is what you and I call the wave. A whole lot of photons flowing in a particular direction at a particular time, at a particular wavelength, you and I call that a wave. Over to you, Wesley.
Okay, so then the Lorentz force should apply to photon, and the trajectory of the particle with a positive or negative charge under the influence of magnetic field is directed perpendicularly to the traveling photon. I use word photon because it is the word that's supposed to be used, electromagnetic wave. So now we're talking about something that in one statement of your some theoretic states, we cannot bend the light. The photon doesn't have a mass. If it doesn't have a mass, why the Lorentz law applies to that? Or it's not? Back to you, sir.
I know where he's going with this, I think, Dick.
An electromagnetic wave can be bent when it goes through a medium that has a different velocity factor or dielectric constant, which are strongly related to each other. So, when that wave on 10 gigahertz goes through that air mass between me and Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, and the air down low has a higher humidity content compared to the air up high, and water is what's making that humidity, and water has a high dielectric constant. Water has a dielectric constant of 81, hugely higher compared to air. So water-laden air, higher humidity air, has a much higher dielectric constant. Therefore, the velocity of the wave through the higher humidity air is slower. So the portion of the wave that's down closer to the earth moves slower than the portion of the wave that's in the drier air up higher. Slower down low, higher up high. That's a fancy way of saying that the wave going through that medium with that variation of dielectric constant versus altitude, that wave will be bent downward when it travels what you think is parallel to the earth. So the medium itself can bend the wave by way of its velocity factor phenomena. I don't think you can bend an electromagnetic wave with a magnetic field. And I know that now you would like to know how this all relates to ferrite material and the way a circulator works. Let me drop.
Yes, I do.
First of all, in order to explain a ferrite, I have to first explain a Yig filter, because I think they're related. In the case of yttrium iron garnet, a kind of ferrite material, I take a sphere of that material, and it's made up of a whole bunch of molecules, and those molecules have definite, significant magnetic properties. It is a, I think it's a ferromagnetic material. As such, I know for a fact that you bring a magnet near a ferrite, a Yig sphere, you can pick them up with a magnet. So they certainly respond to a magnet. I know that when a magnetic field is applied to a Yig sphere, the individual molecules of that Yig material obey precession. In other words, the vector that represents the direction of rotation of the electrons around that individual nucleus, you align up all of those vectors that represent the rotational vector. You line up all those rotational vectors in a material, and you and I call that a permanent magnet. But the Yig material, you can line up those material, you can line up those individual atoms, their magnetic vectors, but they have a resonance phenomenon. At a particular frequency, they will precess. The electromagnetic wave that you're applying is applying a cyclic force, magnetic force, that's different than the steady state magnetic field that you've applied.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So the steady state magnetic field is applying a force that's trying to align all those vectors. The electromagnetic wave that you're applying to the ferrite material is creating a disturbing force. The interaction between the two is what you and I call precession. When I take that child's top and I spin it on the floor, gravity is pulling on that top and trying to tip it over. It's applying a force that's at right angles to the rotational vector. If I spin the top perfectly, and it hasn't started wobbling yet, the rotational vector is straight up away from the floor. But eventually the top settles a little bit. That vector is a little bit off to one side. And gravity is now applying a force to that top, trying to tip it over. In any gyroscope, you apply a force that tries to move the gyroscope at right angles to its axis. It responds by precessing. It responds by moving at right angles. If I take a gyroscope where the shaft is sticking straight up, and I try to push the top of the shaft to the south, that shaft will respond by going either to the east or to the west. It moves at right angles to the force I've applied, depending on whether or not the gyroscope is spinning clockwise or counterclockwise. That's the precession effect of a gyroscope. At the molecular level, I believe that ferrite material has this kind of gyroscopic action. Let me drop. So the steady-state magnetic field is trying to align all of these vectors. The electromagnetic wave I'm applying is creating a disturbing force, a cyclic disturbing force. And the individual molecules, their magnetic vectors, precess exactly like that top. The interesting thing about Yig material is the rate at which it precesses is exactly directly proportional to the steady-state magnetic field. I put the exact same electromagnetic field into that ferrite, and I change the steady-state magnetic field by doubling its strength. The individual magnetic vectors will now precess at exactly twice the rate. The precession of those magnetic fields creates a coupling mechanism in the Yig filter between the input coil and the output coil. The input coil is a simple loop of wire that maybe goes around the Yig sphere with the plane of the loop is north-south. That's the input coil. The output coil has the plane of its loop east-west. Except for the Yig material that's in the center, those two loops of wire are exactly at right angles to each other, no energy couples between them. They are isolated, even though they're occupying the same chunk of space. I put a Yink sphere in the middle of those two coils. Essentially, nothing happens. I lower the resonant frequency of each of those two coils a little bit. Big deal. I put a magnetic material in there. But now I put a steady-state magnetic field parallel to the plane of each of those loops. I put a steady-state magnetic field in there, and the Yink material starts doing its precessing when I apply a signal to the input coil. The precessing creates a coupling mechanism.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
The precessing creates a coupling mechanism between the input coil and the output coil. Energy from the input coil gets coupled into the Yink material. The Yink material is precessing, so cyclically that energy is being coupled in phase and out of phase to the output coil. And it only happens at the resonant frequency where the Yink material is precessing. The beauty of a Yink filter is that once I have calibrated, if I know that it runs at exactly 2 gigahertz at 1 gauss, I know it's going to run at exactly 4 gigahertz at 2 gauss, and so on. It's a direct linear proportion with extreme accuracy. So as a tunable Yink filter that covers at least an octave, in some cases multiple octaves, some of the Yink filters I've used scan between 12 between 2 and 12 gigs, and I believe there's a version that goes between 2 and 18 gigs. And across that whole frequency range, 2 to 18 gigahertz, it has extreme linearity. You tell me the strength of the magnetic field, and I tell you exactly what frequency it's on. So I've got a coil of wire around this structure. I change the current in that coil of wire. It changes the strength of the magnetic field, and the Yink material tunes in this beautiful linear manner. Yink material does that. Now, once I accept that phenomena, and I take that exact same material, and I lay it as two hockey pucks into a circulator. Let me drop. In the case of the circulator, I'm not necessarily looking for resonance. It's not a Yink filter. I don't have a simple input coupling loop and an output coupling loop and a small sphere of the Yink material. I've got these two great big plates of material. But the local magnetic field at right angles to those two hockey pucks means that the signal that propagates around the circle of the circulator, the wave that propagates clockwise moves at one velocity, the wave that moves counterclockwise moves at another velocity, and that differential velocity allows me to get this isolation phenomenon by which I put signal into port number one, it comes out of port number two. Put a signal into port number two, it comes out of port number three. Put a signal into port number three, and comes out of port number one. Everything works beautifully clockwise. Put a signal into port number one, yes, it comes out of port number two, but none of it comes out of port number three. It appears to only propagate clockwise. In reality, inside of that circulator, there really is a wave going clockwise around the path of those three ports, and there's a wave going counterclockwise. And the two waves are moving at a different velocity factor. And those two velocity factors come out in phase with the next port. I put a signal into port number one. Some of it goes directly to port number two. Some of it goes around the back way from port number three to port number two to port, from port number three to port number two. And that longer path propagates faster. The shorter path propagates slower. And they come out directly in phase at port number two when I put in a signal at port number one. I may have it backwards, but I think you see the principle. Now, why it propagates faster and slower, I haven't yet pinned that one down, but I'm reasonably sure that that's what's taking place, Wesley. N2XJN.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
N2XJN, K2RIW.
Two questions. Is the Yink material elementary material for the ferrite? Second, is the photon, based on your wording, not immune or actually circulating because of the gravitational force?
Somebody translate that going noise, please.
Individual photons of a wave, it is my belief, within reason, have essentially zero response to a magnetic field. The photon itself, in free space, does not respond to a magnetic field, does not respond to gravity. But there's a catch on that one. There is a coupling to gravity, but it's an extremely minor one. If I'm looking at a, what is it called now? Pulsar is not the right word. These very strong emitting devices at the limit of the observable universe. These very loud objects.
Quasar?
You said quasar? Yes. Quasi-stellar objects. Thank goodness we got somebody around who knows all these things. A quasar is a very loud object, very far away, probably formed at the beginning of the Big Bang, so to speak. Some of the very early universe material as it come together the first time was very violent. So these quasars are very violent material phenomena, very far away. And if between me and that quasar that I'm looking at, I have an extremely heavy, complete galaxy, 10 to the 10 stars, that's 10 billion stars, really heavy object, midway between me and that quasar, I will now see that quasar many times in a row, because that wave, the electromagnetic wave, the photons coming out of that quasar are being extremely gently bent by that huge, massive object. So there's an extremely light coupling. At a galactic scale, you can just barely see it. But when it comes to something at the solar system size or the Earth size, I think you can safely say there is essentially no coupling between a magnetic field and a wave and a photon field. Just like I think there is essentially no coupling between a magnetic field or a gravity wave. I think gravity or magnetic has almost zero coupling. And the word almost, you got to be careful here. Just like we say that a photon has almost no mass, and we say neutrinos have almost no mass, in both cases the mass is so extremely small that within all reason you can assume it to be zero, and you're going to be accurate 99% of the time. But I suspect if you go deep enough, everything has a little bit of mass to it. Yeah, go ahead, John.
Dick, I believe you're 100% right, because if you remember, actually, the gravitational pull or effect of the planet or the galaxy is distorting the time continuum. That photon is traveling in what it thinks a straight line. It's not the gravity affecting the photon. It's warping the time continuum.
Which sounds like it's changing the rate of propagation of something, doesn't it, John?
Yes, it's following that curve, and it's taking longer, and that's why we see that delay in its position.
But at the scale that you and I usually dwell, when we're not doing a very deep radio astronomy or optical astronomy experiment, except for a very deep astronomy experiment, I think you and I, Wesley, can assume that photons and electromagnetic waves do not respond to gravity, do not respond to a magnetic field. And I think 99% of the time we're going to be right. Into X-JN, K2RIW.
Yeah, can you give us a closer picture on the geek material?
Yeah, I have been in the factory where YIG material is manufactured. You literally take powdered yttrium, powdered iron, and powdered garnet material, mix it together with the right ratio in a crucible at very high temperatures, cool it down as this crystal. I'm not quite sure how they do that. I didn't see that happening. And they go through an extremely elaborate process, a mechanical process, to make each of these individual YIG spheres into an extremely accurate round sphere of a very specific diameter. They put them into this abrasive track where wind is blowing against them, and they're circulating around this abrasive track with some kind of abrasive material, and they automatically form themselves into nearly perfect spheres, and they keep running this process until you get exactly the right diameter. Then they go through a very elaborate procedure to rate the quality of each one of these Higgs spheres to make sure there's no flaws in the individual crystal. I presume the crystals are grown in order to be flawless, very similar to the way you grow silicon or germanium. When you're doing that purification process, you're growing a crystal. You start off with a seed and you grow this crystal. I think that's what I think is going on. So the Yig material is a crystal that has an extremely exact grain orientation, very, very few flaws of the individual molecules of that crystal lattice, a very specific size, and a very specific ratio of those three materials. You do that all just right. There's a whole lot of art and science to that. It's quite a fancy recipe. And I'm trying to think of the name of the company in Santa Clara, California, that Airborne Instrument Laboratory owned that company that was building Yig oscillators and Yig filters. Yig Tech was the name of the company, Santa Clara, California. I was there. I watched them do the process. Maybe that helped.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Maybe that helps a little bit, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW.
How the Yig material, then, if it contains ferrite or ferrite particles, differ from the ferrite material?
Yeah, now I don't know. The hockey puck of material that's used in a circulator and the Yig material that's used in a Yig filter, I believe there's a relationship between the two. And I think there's some magnetic precession phenomena is going on in both materials. It is my belief that the hockey puck of material that goes into a circulator is nowhere near as exact as the material that goes into a Yig filter. In the case of a Yig filter, you're looking for an extremely high Q. You want very pure crystal formation in order to get that high Q. In the case of the hockey puck Yig-like material, ferrite material, that goes into a circulator, I don't think that degree of exactness is required. At least I've watched people build circulators. That was a product that was being done by a division of Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I watched a particular little old cook go through that process. Let me drop. And it looked like he could use various slabs of the hockey puck material and get almost the same performance out of the circulator. The performance of the circulator was how well he impedance matched the three input connectors that go to this Y-shaped conductor that looks like a piece of tri-plate strip line. So it's a Y-shaped piece of tri-plate strip line that is sandwiched between two hockey pucks of ferrite material, which then goes into a magnetic structure, which creates a magnetic field at right angles to the tri-plate strip line, if you know what I mean. And the strength of the magnetic field determine the frequency at which you got the best isolation. You can take almost any circulator that you can buy on the surplus market, no matter what frequency it's on, and within reason, at least 50%, I think you could shift it up or down in frequency by simply changing the strength of the magnetic field. Add extra refrigerator magnets on the outside that either are aiding or bucking the magnetic field, and watch it on a spectrum analyzer. You're watching the isolation, and you'll watch the notch of isolation move up and down in frequency. I've done that. Talked to a lot of guys that have done it. A lot of guys have bought circulators that were designed for 8 gigs. They increased the magnetic field, and they became beautiful circulators at 10 gigs for the ham band. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Another comment too, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, John.
Please keep my friend home.
Dick, if we look at Einstein's work, I think we can almost prove that neutrinos and photons have no mass because the acceleration up to the speed of light, the mass would be almost infinite. So that may be one of the descriptions of pure energy.
I have a problem with that because we took acceleration factor, then we're talking about something that is lighter being able to be to be put into the motion faster than something that is heavier to be put with the same force to the motion faster. Back to you.
Relevant to mass.
Yeah, but you got a good point there, John. We now know that most of the electromagnetic waves that you and I care about in free space move at exactly what we call the speed of light. So if those photons had mass, it would take an infinite amount of energy to move them that fast. You and I can take a laser pointer that's running an extremely small fraction of a milliwatt. I'm putting very little energy in there. And out of that laser pointer comes light pouring out very easily, moving at exactly the speed of light if I was doing it in a vacuum. And I didn't put an infinite amount of energy in there to do it. So what you're saying, and I'm agreeing with you, that's a strong piece of evidence that those photons coming out of that laser pointer of mine must be extremely close to zero in mass, because I put very little energy in there in order to get them at the speed of light moving out of there. Over to you, John.
Yeah, that's my pretty firm belief. I think that's QED. But Wesley seems to see it differently. Let's hear what he has to say. Over to you, Dick.
Go ahead, Wes.
Wesley likes Dick. I like Dick. It's a fat Dick.
Hey. Fiction. Before I go to that, we have a circulator that operates in total vacuum. Would you see any difference between a circulator operating in ambient temperature and with the air, and a circulator operating in total vacuum and take into consideration the material from the chemistry study?
I'm so glad that Leslie joined our club, oh my!
At Air Buenos Laboratory, where they had a special division that made very high-quality circulators for very specific applications. I'm having trouble remembering the name of the guy who did it. It'll come to me in a minute. I watched him do it. I watched them build circulators that they tuned up in the laboratory, that after they were tuned and sealed and put all together, and they did the shake, rattle, and roll to make sure that they were in good shape, they were then applied to a satellite and put into space. And no special consideration was given for the fact that it was tuned up in a laboratory with air, and it was about to go into space with hard vacuum, and there was no seal around that satellite. That all those components of that satellite were going to be bathed in that hard vacuum, except for the components that were in a hermetically sealed package, like the amplifiers. The circulators are never put into a hermetically sealed package that I saw. So I think they work beautifully in air or in vacuum. Over to you, Wesley.
Were the vacuum circulator used, or were there just circulators that were tuned in the air with no care taking for the vacuum inside?
Wesley has an endless supply of stupid fucking questions.
From everything I saw, Wes, the fact that that particular component was about to go into a vacuum environment, to my knowledge, they did nothing special. In other words, the dielectric constant of the air that's inside that circulator didn't matter. Because if you look at the construction of the circulator, there is essentially no air inside. You've got the center brass strip line sandwiched between two hockey pucks, sandwiched into a shielded structure to act like tri-plate strip line, with fixed magnets on the outside, and then a magnetic structure around that. There was no air spaces in there per se, but in between those individual layers, there was some air. The fact that the air was there in the laboratory, and the fact that the air was going to leave that circulator, the little bit of air that's inside, was going to leave when it was put into space, I didn't see anybody worrying about that. They worried about how well hermetically sealed some of the amplifiers were, but the circulators, I saw no evidence that they were hermetically sealing the package of the circulator. Whether the air is inside or not inside, I don't think they cared. N2XJN, K2LIW.
Was that Mother Nature was never able to make a circulator by itself, and we were able to produce it in terms of the photon.
Stupid fucking question! Unbelievable.
Yeah, I see no evidence that Mother Nature ever made a circulator. Could I say that the gravity lensing effect of a quasar being observed multiple times around the perimeter of a midway located extremely massive galaxy, could I call that a slight bending of the wave and that's starting to move in the direction of a circulator? I don't think so. I've never heard any evidence that Mother Nature ever made a circulator as far as electromagnetic waves or light waves are concerned. Well, there are kinds of crystals that obey a phenomenon called birefringence. In other words, the crystal behaves a little bit differently when the signal goes from left to right or right to left of the crystal, where the signal becomes a linear signal going into a particular optical crystal can come out circular polarized. Birefringent crystals can do that. And there's also a kind of... there are kinds of crystal materials where you put a magnetic field through the crystal and it changes its electromagnetic properties. I think a Bragg cell uses some of that phenomenon. So once you've got a material that the electromagnetic wave is propagating through, now you can operate on the electromagnetic wave. But you're not operating on the electromagnetic wave directly. You're operating on the material, the medium, and that in turn causes the electromagnetic wave to behave differently when it goes through that medium. But you're not operating on the electromagnetic wave itself. I don't think in free space you can do anything to a magnetic wave. By a magnetic field or a gravity wave, within reason, I don't think you can touch it. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
No, I'm still dragging the subject of the circulators. You say that let's say 2 gigahertz to 10 gigahertz frequency is the frequency typically utilized for the circulators. And what is the frequency of photon?
I have seen circulators as low as 150 megacycles. I have seen circulators as high as 50 gigahertz. I have reason to believe they're built at much higher frequencies and much lower frequencies. You don't go much lower because they tend to get very large. You don't go much higher because there are other ways you can get that phenomena at very high frequencies, optical focusing techniques and whatever, quasi-optical techniques. So what you're asking now is, could I build a circulator that operates at optical frequencies? And there I don't know, but I bet you it's possible. Over to you, Wes.
I wonder what is the highest possible frequency that will allow to the photon or to the electromagnetic wave to still behave the way that it behaves in within the range that you mentioned, but this.
Stupid fucking question! Every minute, unbelievable!
I think we're now talking about somewhat exotic materials, crystal-like materials. Yes, the ferrite material in a circulator and the ferrite-like material that's in a Yeag filter, these are crystalline materials, crystal lattice materials. Once I've got a crystal lattice material, and it's got the right kind of polarization-sensitive dielectric constant, is what I'm going to call it. In theory, I can buy or build crystal material that has a certain dielectric constant in the X direction, a slightly different dielectric constant in the Y direction, and a slightly different, again, dielectric constant in the Z direction. I can buy material that has that kind of biasing to it, crystals. And once I own that kind of material, birefringent is one of them, and there's a whole lot of others, I can now propagate a light wave through that crystal and do some exotic things like converting linear polarization to elliptical polarization, to clockwise circular, to counterclockwise circular, to getting total reflection like you do in a pentaprism that's in a single lens reflex camera. You can do all kinds of fancy things once you've got these crystalline materials that have optical properties. I haven't heard of anybody building a circulator that way, but I'll bet you it's possible. Over to you, Wes.
Comment, Dick.
It's Gershaw.
Dick, couldn't we do the same thing, build a circulator with dichroic mirrors and prismatics?
Okay, the typical radio circulators I've worked with do their thing because the wave that travels around the circle of that Y-shaped triplate strip line coaxial-like structure, the signal that travels in a clockwise direction travels at a different velocity than the signal that travels in a counterclockwise direction. So if I can make materials which violate reciprocity, and that's what the YIG materials do. YIG materials and ferrite materials appear to violate reciprocity. Because of the presence of the local magnetic field, you could say the signal that goes from east to west moves at one speed, and the signal that goes from west to east moves at another speed. That's a violation of reciprocity. So biased magnetic materials and amplifiers, active amplifiers, and to a small degree even mixers, these objects do not obey reciprocity. Once I've intentionally made something that disobeys reciprocity, and if I'm smart enough, boy, you can do all kinds of fancy things for signal processing, for frequency, polarimetry, direction of travel, direction of reflection, magnitude of reflection, and so on. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Okay, Dick. I just thought that with prisms and dichroic mirrors, I think you could achieve the same lack of reciprocity. I'm just running that through my head, but it just came to my silly brain.
Yeah, where you studied these kinds of mirrors and materials, have you seen someone specifically state, out of a good optical engineering handbook of some kind, that when you apply the signal from east to west, it behaves this way, and you apply the signal from west to east, it behaves this other way? Do you remember seeing that statement in one form or another? And if not, you and I should keep an eye out for that. Maybe start Googling some of those word combinations. Over to you, John.
Well, the one thing I do know is if we were to take a white light, pass it through a prism, we break out into the colors. If it's then fed through a dichroic mirror and reflected back to the prism, you won't have white light coming out of it.
Okay, if I used a real mirror and reflected all those things, a real curved mirror, maybe it'd have to be parabolic, and reflect those light waves back, I think I will reconstruct light, white light. But in the case of a dichroic mirror, what do you believe the dichroic mirror is doing to that rainbow spectrum coming out of that prism? Over to you, John.
It'll reflect back only one particular spectrum, or it's a broad spectrum, but a spectrum of light. The others will pass right through it. Now, if you could arrange a couple of those, you could wind up changing the white light coming back out of the prism into almost any color you wanted.
There you go, Jack. Go ahead, Eric. That you've worked with some of this stuff.
Oh, consider this. The dichroics, dichroics have a two-way property, but it doesn't act for change of velocity. Every time you see a picture on television from a TV camera, there's a beam splitter, which is essentially a prism, is a beam splitter, doesn't break it up into colors. The dichroics, actually, in essence, will allow the full spectrum to pass one way, but acts as a filter in the other direction. So, once it's been filtered, it's missing the other parts of the spectrum, so you're not going to make white light out of it again.
If I understand you correctly, Eric, this dichroic material that you've worked with that are inside of broadcast video cameras will allow certain portions of the spectrum to flow through the material east to west, but the exact same wavelength will not flow back through it west to east. Is that done to stop multiple reflections within the camera and in order to filter the red, green, and blue for those individual detectors? Is that part of what's going on here, Eric? K2EJ, K2RIW.
That's precisely it. The out output of the dichroic, actually, there's only one in the gamma, one filter, or one dichroic is specific to allow all the spectrum to pass through it, and that would be the one that reflects the green, because once it becomes separated, missing the green component, then the other two are broader spectrum mirrors. You know, actually, cameras that only use two of them, and they fine-tune what's hitting the sensor by putting an actual narrow bandpass filter of the frequency that you're particularly interested in. There's a certain part of the CIE curve that certain filters are designed to pass, which essentially become the red, green, and blue, although it's not like you have a single frequency of, say, a 4,000 angstroms for green that just passes through. It's much broader than that, but within the CIE curve, those particular frequencies of light that produce the maximum output and also are kind of attuned to skin colors. So most people don't realize it, but your skin reflects mostly green light. KQIWK2.
When you're doing a critical alignment of a broadcast camera to make sure the chromaticity comes out right, I can see how the red, green, and blue detector, red, green, and blue amplifiers can be adjusted for their gain, transfer curve, gamma curve, and whatever. Electronically, I can see that. But I'm wondering at the optical level before the red, green, and blue detector, and you probably have a red, green, and blue, and maybe a white detector, but before the three or four detectors, does any of the tuning process change magnetic fields, changes voltage, changes angles, changes distances of any of the optical quasi-transparent materials in order to do this critical tuning? Is there anything other than electronics after the detectors that is tuned in order to make the camera really behave correctly? Over to you, Eric, K2RIW.
Well, in terms of the optics, you can consider the optics to be static, whereas the optics itself, the green curve will go from, 3,500 to 4,200 angstroms of light passing through. It has a bandpass. You can consider them to be bandpass filters. As far as being dynamic and being able to adjust things, that all happens after the sensor. So we actually use the electronics by using variable gain, gamma correction, aperture correction. We have something called flare. There are a lot of circuits that are involved in terms of correcting the optical mistake.
Testing, KB1THN.
KB1THN, they're coming through very nicely. Does the camera go out of alignment? Probably not. Are the sensors charge-coupled devices? Is that the current sensor technology, charge-coupled device? And if the camera suddenly goes from a dark scene to a bright scene, in the old days of Vidicon-like things, you used to get a ballooning effect. You never see that anymore. So how does the camera do such a beautiful job of adjusting for variations in local light intensity? I mean, I might have the camera on some kind of a gimbal, and I'm swinging from a dark scene to a bright scene, and the camera seems to correct very nicely, very fast. Is all of that electronic? And do the photocoupled, charge-coupled devices have that much dynamic range that they don't start flat-topping and, run into a shoulder or a toe problem? K2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2EJ. Well, light years ahead of charge-coupled devices. The Hyperhead type of, every manufacturer has their trade name for their product. But today's sensors are CMOS sensors. Even your Nikon has those type of sensors in it. The reason why you don't see, first of all, you said that cameras don't drift anymore, which is pretty much true, but in the days of Viticon and Plumicon, I'll give you an example.